All right, the first case we'll hear is McBurney v. Young. And Ms. Nichols, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I represent the appellants, Mark McBurney and Roger Hurlburt. Virginia's Freedom of Information Act, or VFOIA, limits the right to access documents to citizens of Virginia. Because it discriminates between citizens and non-citizens, VFOIA violates the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4 and the Dormant Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. Discriminatory laws that burden an out-of-stater's fundamental right or privilege violate the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and there are several rights and privileges protected by the clause at issue here. First, the citizens-only provision violates the Privileges and Immunities Clause because it prevents Mr. Hurlburt from practicing his common calling in Virginia. And it is undisputed that practicing a common calling is a right protected by the clause. Mr. Hurlburt runs a nationwide records retrieval business, and VFOIA's citizens-only provision prevents him from doing business in Virginia. Therefore, the citizens-only provision is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has held that shrimp fishermen, pipeline workers, and lawyers all have the right to practice their trades in a sister state on the same terms as citizens of that state.
Are those analogous? I would think state law says an out-of-stater can't practice law in the state, can't be admitted to the law. Is a provision that addresses practice of law. But the Virginia FOIA provision doesn't address any business. It just talks about information, and it just happens to be incidentally that that is what your client wants. But the fact is, not every state may have a FOIA, or they don't have to have a FOIA. And when they do have a FOIA, they're not addressing a business, are they?
Well, Your Honor, in response to that, the privileges and immunities cases with regard to common calling are focused on the effect of the provision, that the provision has on the ability of a person to pursue their common calling in that state.
So a state that says we're not going to have a FOIA, and we're not going to give you information. You send a letter in, and we're not going to give that information out. And therefore, Virginia treats your client differently than Kentucky does, which has a FOIA. Is that the argument?
No, Your Honor, that would be perfectly constitutional because Virginia's law wouldn't, in that case, distinguish between citizens and non-citizens. A state may not have a FOIA, but if it does have a law, it cannot discriminate between citizens and non-citizens.
Now, are you talking only in common calling context now or overall?
This discussion, I think, is about the common calling context, but that's the Privileges and Immunities Clause generally is just an anti-discrimination principle so that a state can not have a law or, you know, cannot have a FOIA or not have something else. But if it does have such a law, it cannot discriminate between citizens and non-citizens. And that's...
Well, I mean, I understand that as a general principle, but the Privileges and Immunities Law is a charitable scant. So I think we really have to look back at what the Supreme Court has decided over the years. And in the common calling context, I'm not aware of there ever being a case where the statute in question was not a statute that was specifically directed at a particular trade. Can you give us one?
No, I cannot. But again, just to emphasize, the analysis is always about the effect that that it has on someone's trade. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a licensing statute. So for example, in Hicklin, which is the Alaska Hire case about oil pipeline workers, that's not a licensing case. So it doesn't have to be in that context, but certainly the focus, the analysis is always on the effect. And if I could also just note, I think it's well understood that freedom of information laws are frequently used for commercial purposes. And the Virginia Supreme Court has said that VFOIA, if you're requesting documents for commercial purposes under VFOIA, you have just as much of a right to get those documents as otherwise. And again, I think it's well understood that it's freedom of information laws are frequently used for commercial purposes. And no less than the shrimp fishermen, pipeline workers, and lawyers that the Supreme Court has said, those common callings are protected. Mr. Hurlburt
those
has...
Those statutes pretty clearly address a business calling, an enterprise, entrepreneurial. It's just hard in my mind to say that this is like a lawyer case or a shrimp case. This is not... There's nothing to indicate in this record that Virginia was concerned about the business of providing information, and that was the reason they were restricting, favoring local Virginia purveyors of information. This access to the court was, to the government was, I thought, linked somehow to the fact that a Virginia citizen has access to transparency, to the government that it elects, to whom it pays taxes.
Okay. Your Honor, first, there's a lot in there, but first, again, the focus is on the effect on his ability to practice his common calling. And under neither the privileges...
Well, every statute has an effect on a business, right? I mean, if you're going to use this sort of ripple effect, doesn't the effect have to be a little bit more apparent? Direct?
For Mr. Hurlburt, the impact is direct. He can't practice his common calling in Virginia. He's barred. That's even more of an inhibition than...
Nobody says he can't practice his... He can open his business in Virginia.
He cannot retrieve the records in the way that he can...
That's like saying I can't buy inventory in the state. I can't buy wine. I mean, I can't... There's a difference between regulating his calling and regulating the inventory. When they're not even focusing on the business. But I understand your point. You're a little bit of an extension.
And to get to your point, Judge Niemeyer, about the justification that the state has offered here in terms of allowing state citizens now to get access to those documents to hold their elected officials accountable and so on, we can see that that's a substantial state interest. So under the Privileges and Immunities Clause test, once a fundamental right is burdened, it's subject to scrutiny, and the statute can still be upheld if the state can show that it has a substantial state interest and the discrimination is narrowly tailored to that state interest. Here, it's not. There's nothing about also permitting out-of-staters to access these documents that inhibits an in-stater's right to access these documents. You know, it's not a finite resource. It's not a zero-sum game. The state can still achieve that purpose by opening up the records to non-citizens. And indeed, the text of the law actually also says that its purpose is to prevent secrecy by government. And certainly restricting who gets access to the documents doesn't further that purpose. The Commonwealth has also discussed that perhaps a substantial state interest, or has said that a substantial state interest, is an increased increased administrative burden associated with opening BFOIA to non-citizens. That argument's problematic on at least two levels. First, BFOIA permits state and local agencies to recoup costs related to responding to BFOIA requests by charging fees. And to the extent that the statute does not permit the agencies to recoup the full costs, that's a problem with the statute, and its flaws do not make it constitutional. Second, for a state to claim that its otherwise unconstitutional discrimination is justified by an increased administrative burden, it must do more than make, to use the Supreme Court's language in Mulaney, a, quote, bald assertion that the administrative costs will be prohibitively burdensome. But that's all the Commonwealth and its amici have done. They've offered no evidence about the actual costs associated with responding to out-of-state requests or even in-state requests. And what we do know, that 44 states do not have a citizens-only provision in their freedom of information laws, would indicate that permitting non-citizens access to state records is not prohibitively burdensome. and Tangier Sound in this court.
That hardly proves. That doesn't follow at all. A state may be willing to bear the burden. I mean, the fact that states do it doesn't mean it's not burdensome. It just doesn't follow. It seems to me FOIA is burdensome to every government. Now, the extent to which they can recoup it or do recoup it is another question.
Right. Judge Niemeyer, I mean, certainly that doesn't decide the question. I agree.
No, it may not. But I think we've got to stay within the bounds of what follows.
Sure. Well, here, the thing is, the burden here is actually on the government to show that the additional burden it's placing on out-of-staters is narrowly tailored to the additional costs that are incurred by those out-of-staters. And it's the state's burden to come up with evidence that its discrimination is justified, and the state here has come up with no evidence to that effect. In Tangier Sound, in this court, the Commonwealth made the same argument that it makes here. The out-of-staters...
What is the argument that permits state citizens only to vote for government?
In that case, Your Honor, probably, you know, if we ring this through the analysis, it probably does pass the scrutiny because diluting the vote of in-staters is probably, you know, narrowly tailored.
What's wrong with that?
Diluting the...
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to get to the fun. You're making these arguments that sort of sound like due process arguments. But what we're really doing is we're delineating in this clause between those rights that we want citizens to enjoy in all states and those rights that each state has a right as its own sovereign to insist on. Now, it seems to me if we say only Virginia citizens can vote for governor, we have to be advancing some interest.
Yeah.
And I was asking you, what interest was that?
Okay. The interest there, Your Honor, would be because those individuals live in the state and they're governed by those laws. And it's excluding out-of-staters from voting for...
Well, the Virginia argues by the same token, if that's as easy as saying that, then Virginia argues that the citizens of Virginia are the ones that pay the taxes. They elect the officials. They are the officials. They have access to the officials. That they're the only ones that we ought to open our books to because it's a matter of state-citizen relationship. And we're going to let anybody in the state that elects our government look into our books and our documents because we want it to be transparent. But with respect to whether a New Yorker comes down and looks, we're not interested in going to that effort. Because this right, I think they take position, is similar to the right to limit people who vote. How about the payment of fees in state parks? Could the state waive the fees for the citizens in the state and charge out-of-staters fees to go in their state parks?
I think the answer is probably no. And if, for example, there's the...
Why is that?
Because in that
citizens
case...
Citizens pay for it through their taxes, and the out-of-staters don't pay for it.
Your Honor, the Commonwealth made the exact same argument in Tangier Sound, and this court rejected that argument. In Tangier Sound, the Commonwealth argued that the out-of-staters' use of state resources justifies placing additional burdens on non-citizens seeking to practice their trade in Virginia.
How about universities? How about lowering the tuition for in-state citizens to go to the university?
Your Honor,
can the state do that?
The Supreme Court has said that education that is not a fundamental, public education is not a fundamental right. So that wouldn't fall within the scope of the
privilege. So FOIA is a fundamental right, but getting an education is not.
Common calling is a fundamental right, and that's undisputed.
Well, common calling, that the courts address that, but how about getting FOIA information?
Getting FOIA, and we argue that...
Documents, which is a fairly recent phenomenon.
We also argue that there's a right to access information, but that's a separate argument from the common calling issue. With regard, again, this is what the Third Circuit had held in Lee versus Minner, is that because people have the right to engage in political discourse across state lines, that access to that kind of information is really important.
Do you see the claims by either gentlemen or both, for lack of a better way of describing it, because the Supreme Court doesn't really seem to have addressed it in these terms that it uses with other constitutional issues. Are the challenges as applied challenges or facial challenges?
It's as applied, Your Honor. With regard to Mr. Horbert, certainly is as applied to his common calling and his situation. With regard to the larger argument about the right to access to information, that's an as-applied challenge, but as a practical matter, it's as applied to everyone. So these are as-applied challenges, Your Honor. And unless there are further questions on that, I'll move on to the Commerce Clause very quickly. Again, the statute discriminates between state citizens and non-citizens. It advantages Virginia-based records retrieval services over non-Virginia-based records retrieval services. And because it discriminates, because the VFOIA citizens only provision discriminates on its face and in effect, it's virtually per se invalid under the Commerce Clause, and it's subject to strict scrutiny, not the Pike balancing test. And because it's subject to strict scrutiny, it's only constitutional if the Commonwealth can show that the citizens-only provision advances a legitimate local purpose that cannot adequately be served by reasonable non-discriminatory alternatives. And again, to the extent that the Commonwealth's asserted legitimate local interest is preventing an increased administrative burden, that is insufficient for the statute to survive strict scrutiny. Run-of-the-mill administrative costs, even assuming that they exist here, are not a valid reason to burden interstate commerce. And in Oregon Waste, the Supreme Court explained that the fact that in-staters paid more general state taxes than out-of-staters, which is, I think, what the Commonwealth's argument is here, was that's insufficient to justify placing additional burdens on out-of-staters. And if the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nitt.
Thank you.
You have some rebuttal. All right, Mr. Ketchum.
May it please the court, Duncan Getchell for Deputy Commissioner Young. With respect to Mr. McBurney's claim, no court has ever held that the desire to obtain information from a state unconnected with a common calling or political issues of natural interest is a fundamental right protected by the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Lee offers no support for McBurney. The Third Circuit recognized, quote, the reach of the clause is not well developed, but found that it extends to, quote, the right to engage in political process with regards to matters of national, political, and economic importance. Now, appellees submit that Lee is wrongly decided, that it's conflated some First Amendment issues in with privileges and immunities, but it doesn't matter whether this court finds it persuasive or not, because on an as-applied challenge, it obviously turned on the nature of the litigants and the nature of the information sought, and there is absolutely no support for the proposition that Mr. McBurney's request implicates issues of national importance, because it involves Virginia's standard operating procedures from McBurney's personal experiences in child support. McBurney, therefore, is forced to argue broadly that the right to know is itself a fundamental right without regard to context, as long as the resulting information can be used for personal advocacy or to evaluate possible legal action. This just simply is beyond any precedent whatsoever under the Privileges and Immunities Clause.
Mr. Getchell, the fact that he makes a request regarding support and those things involving child support, Virginia is involved in a signer to the Uniform Reciprocal Child Support Act. And if, in fact, this information might disclose that Virginia is not diligently pursuing support reference to out-of-state children as an impact, why wouldn't this be something significant beyond just his personal experience that should be exposed and relates directly to Virginia's law in terms of that Uniform Reciprocal Support Act, for example?
Well, I think because that's the fact that something might be civilly important is not sufficient to make it a privilege and an immunity within the meaning of the Article 4 provision. What Mr. McBurney is forced to argue is that because this information might, in some other context, or depending on what he found, in some other circumstance, be of some importance to some discussion by somebody sometime, that's enough. And that just isn't what the precedent would suggest. And Lee itself didn't cut so broadly. Lee itself obviously found it important that we were dealing with a member of the press, that Delaware was a center of corporate activity, and that the debate was national. And so I think on an as-applied challenge, Mr. McBurney is just not a very prepossessing advocate for pushing back the boundaries of the privileges and immunities clause. The right has to be fundamental. And Justice Washington in Corfield versus Coryell on a circuit in 1823 famously defined fundamental rights as those privileges and immunities which are in their nature fundamental, which belong of right to the citizens of all free governments, and which have at all times been enjoyed by the citizens of the several states which compose this union from the time of their becoming free, independent, and sovereign. Well, FOIA just doesn't meet that test. It's not possible to suggest that our governments weren't free before they had FOIA. I would also suggest that the argument being presented by Mr. McBurney has an improper overbreath argument, because he's not trying to debate national issues. He's suggesting somebody else might be able to, and outside of the First Amendment, we don't allow overbreath arguments for constitutional rights. You have to argue your own rights. Now, I would say that we know from good precedent that in-state tuition can favor residents, that compensation funds for insurance companies that go broke or for automobile accidents where there's an uninsured motorist can favor in-state citizens. Government employment can be limited to in-state citizens. Handicap permits can be limited to parking permits can be limited to in-state citizens. Pro hoc motions, pro hoc vici motions by lawyers, even though they're practicing a common calling, can be limited to in-state citizens. So the cases that support these propositions are found at 20, 39, 40, 19, and 30 of our brief. And I would submit that the claim that we can't have FOIA limited to citizens is inconsistent with the fact that we can limit those rights or privileges to citizens. Fundamental rights are, quote, basic to the livelihood of the nation and, quote, important to the maintenance or well-being of the union, Baldwin. This right, privilege to get some documents is just not in that league. So I would suggest that very little was said in support of any claim against McBurney in oral argument. The arguments that are made on behalf of McBurney in the brief are too extravagant to be accepted. And so I clearly think that the district court has to be affirmed on Mr. McBurney's claim. We have separate representation of Hurlbut, and so I will defer to Henrico County on that, except the Attorney General's office does have a duty to defend statutes, and I would note that government functions are not susceptible to Dormant Commerce Clause analysis, Department of Revenue of Kentucky versus Parrish. And I would also note that on Hurlbut's common calling claim, the Lee Court itself wisely avoided the question whether unintended incidental effect on business is enough for privileges and immunities violation. That would make the Privileges and Immunities Clause broader than the Dormant Commerce Clause. And not anything that privileges and immunities has ever been held to mean. It can't be that every indirect, unintended burden on an out-of-state business triggers heightened scrutiny. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Gatchel. Mr. Thorpe.
Thank you. May it please the court, Ben Thorpe representing Thomas Little, the County Director of Real Estate Assessment Division. Counsel for Mr. Hurlburt admitted that there was no case that she was aware of where the fundamental right to practice one's common calling was implicated and a privileges and immunities clause violation found when the only impact on that common calling was indirect and incidental. There are no cases to support her proposition. And what Mr. Hurlburt advances in this case asks this court to venture into new and uncharted territory in terms of its privileges and immunities jurisprudence. To allow a state statute that distinguishes between citizens and non-citizens, but has an incidental and indirect impact on someone's business, if that becomes the standard, then the requirement for a fundamental right to be impacted is essentially read out of privileges and immunities clause law. Because this court observed, or as Justice Niemeyer observed, almost any statute that distinguishes between citizens and non-citizens has the ability to affect someone's business somewhere. Certainly an example could be a state favoring its own residents for admission, not tuition, but for admission to professional schools, engineering or law school or dental school or medical school. States favor their own residents and give them preference in admissions. Well, clearly that affects a trade, but it's not a direct regulation of the trade. In every case where a common calling has been found to be impacted for purposes of the privileges and immunities clause, it has been where there has been a direct regulation of that common calling. There has either been a license or it has been a law about employment, one of the two. The Toomer case dealt with licenses to fish, and it directly said who would get those licenses and at what cost. The Piper case directly dealt with who was allowed to come into a state and practice a profession. In that case, it was attorneys. None of the cases cited by any party or that any party has raised in this have gone so far as to permit a mere incidental or indirect impact to implicate the common calling. Furthermore, what Hurlburt is seeking to do in this instance isn't to come into Virginia and practice his profession. He seeks to be in California and to have Virginia supply him at cost with essentially the raw materials that he wants to use to practice his profession and then sell to clients located outside of Virginia. And that's very different from what was contemplated, certainly at the time that the Constitution was ratified. And different than has been found in those cases where common callings have been implicated. Common calling privileges and immunities, that fundamental right is the right of a non-citizen to practice a trade or profession in a sister state. It's not the right to have government furnish non-residents who carry out their common calling in another state with those raw materials on the same terms as the state does to its own residents.
The council, do you think Virginia could have a law that says out-of-staters can't view movies in Virginia?
Could you repeat that question?
Out-of-state residents cannot see movies in Virginia. You can't go to the theater and see a movie if you're not a Virginia resident.
Your Honor, I think it probably could. At blush, I'm not aware of what fundamental right that hinges on. What fundamental right a person has to go and see a movie. I don't know why any state would choose to do that, but
well, They would probably say they don't know why state, you know, sunshine is the best, you know, medicine to make sure that things are seen and proper. Why should that be restricted to Virginia residents? They might say that too. But so you said that Virginia could do that. They could say, look, we don't want out-of-staters watching movies in our state. So you can't come. You said that'll be fine. There'll be no implication of privilege immunity.
I can think of none. There may be other reasons why Virginia can't do that, but the Privileges and Immunities Clause, I don't believe, presents a bar to it because that's not a fundamental right. It's not a right that, as the court said in Corfield, is basic to the vitality of our nation. You know, view the right to view movies or engage in a recreational activity. I mean, heck, the state of Montana very nearly did the same thing with big game hunting, and the Supreme Court said it was okay. So if viewing a movie is analogous to hunting for big game, in that both of them are recreational activities, well, the state of Montana didn't put an absolute bar on the ability of non-Montanans to hunt big game, but it charged them an extraordinary amount of money compared to what it charged Montana residents to engage in that piece of recreation. And the Supreme Court said that that was okay. The amount of money that Montana was charging for a big game license, if I recall, was in the, for non-residents, was in the thousands of dollars. So a resident of a nearby state, an adjoining state who maybe lived near the border with Montana, you know, the average person could probably, you know, or certainly there were many cases of average people who were no longer able to go and hunt in Montana who otherwise would have.
But that's depleting a resource potentially in the state. Here there's no implication. You're not depleting a resource by applying information.
Well, the court in the Baldwin case did not turn on that fact. Its opinion, if I recall correctly, the court's opinion in the Baldwin, Montana case examined that issue about the state's management of its natural resources, but that wasn't the basis for their decision. The basis for their decision was that ultimately big game hunting is merely a recreational activity, and that doesn't rise to a fundamental right that implicates the Privileges and Immunities Clause.
But isn't that what distinguishes our great democracy, that people have the right to information that informs and inspires one to be a participant in a free government? And if you somehow unfairly, in an untoward way, limit that pipeline of knowledge, that becomes the fundamental implication, doesn't it?
Your Honor.
You talked about movies, for example. The movies helped us get through the Depression. If you looked at the number of people, the average citizen went to the movies two or three times a week during the Depression. It was an escape in terms of a way to get through. So even movies and those kind of things, more than just entertainment, it's the whole thing that makes the difference of the human expression. So why is this not implicated here?
Because while it may have been important to certain individuals, it isn't a right that is basic to the vitality of our nation. I mean, at the end of the day, what you say may be true, but one of the other things that makes our country great is that we're a nation comprised of 50 state sovereigns. And those sovereigns are each allowed in their own capacity and within their limits to do things differently than one another. And states are allowed to favor their own citizens regarding certain things. In-state tuition, and even allowed to favor their own citizens when those favors touch upon a common calling. I mean, West Virginia said that, okay, if you're not a West Virginian, you can practice law in Virginia, in West Virginia, but what you can't do is move for pro hoc vice admission of someone else. And that implicates indirectly someone's common calling, but that was okay. So there are a host of things that states can favor their own citizens for, and there's nothing, you know, in the record to show that access to Virginia records by Virginians and also by media companies, because remember, Virginia's Freedom of Information Act has an exception to the in-state rule for media companies that are in or broadcast into or circulate within Virginia. Virginians and those media companies, there's no representation that they don't do an adequate job of policing the activities of Virginia's government. And ultimately, the state citizens are the ones who vote.
Thank you, Mr. Thorpe.
Thank you, Your Honor. Nichols?
Thank you. First, I'd like to address the comment that the Dormant Commerce Clause does not apply to government services. That's simply not true. As this court probably knows, there are several cases, they're cited in our briefs, in which courts perform Dormant Commerce Clause analyses on government services like trash hauling and toll roads. But it is true that not all government services run afoul of the Dormant Commerce Clause, but you actually have to do the analysis. So, for example, if the government is engaging in falls under the market participant exception, the Dormant Commerce Clause would not prohibit that kind of discrimination there, or if the government is discriminating in favor of itself. And that's what was at issue in United Haulers and Carbone, Kentucky versus Davis. The Supreme Court said, look, what the government can do is discriminate in favor of itself, but what the government cannot do is discriminate between private citizens on the basis of state citizenship, which is exactly what the FOIA does here. And there is a line.
I think discrimination was the key to this law. I make this comment to you because I'd like some help. As I've understood this clause, it is a magical line between state sovereignty, which is recognized, and national union, which is being promoted in the Constitution. And there are certain attributes of a right that are national in nature, and we're going to foster them in every state through the federal Constitution. And there are others that are inherent in the sovereignty of the state. And this was articulated by Justice Washington early on. It's still not totally clear to me. It's still how we analyze that and find these national rights that supersede the right of the sovereign to do what it wants with its own citizens. And it seems to me, for instance, the Montana case is a pretty good example of a situation where state of Montana, for whatever reason, or it may just because it may not be preserving the big game, it may be just to do favors for the citizens of Montana. This is our territory, and the Supreme Court said that's fine. Now, you can make the argument, oh, that has national effect because it's going to affect the game, and the citizens have a right in the game roam across state lines and all this business. But that isn't quite the way the analysis goes. It doesn't go as to whether there's discrimination. It goes to whether the national right is being burdened. And I think to find what a fundamental right is the tricky task. I must say the cases don't give us a great deal of help on it. It's not a very developed right. That'll be our challenge. But if you want to address that, go ahead. I see your time's up, but I'm interested in hearing your views. How do we define this right between what a sovereign, state sovereign can do as opposed to the national union rights?
Your Honor, very quickly, first, I assume you're not asking about the common calling, which has already been recognized.
That's just an example. It doesn't help me much. In other words, the Supreme Court has already picked certain ones, but it's still not clear what is the pattern. I mean, it seems to me there was a good point here made with respect to we're going to train professionals in Virginia, mm-hmm. lawyers who go to the Virginia Law School at a discount. And we're going to favor the Virginia citizens. Not only are we going to favor them financially, we're going to make the class at least, say, 50% Virginians, which excludes non-Virginians, therefore. Now, are you suggesting Virginia, that's not that is a fundamental right that Virginia can't burden?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
Yet it's linked to the common calling notion because it favors Virginia citizens in becoming professional lawyers.
Your Honor, with regard to the education aspect, the Supreme Court has held with regard to other clauses
I'm not talking about what's being held. I'm trying to find out how do we define this fundamental right. I'm giving you an example, which I think should make the task difficult, and because I think there are examples going both ways, and so we can't just loosey-goosey throw about, does it affect interstate commerce? Does it affect the nation? Do we want? There has to be something that we have to find in the law that says the sovereign can do certain things in the interest of the sovereign as a state of the union, and something the sovereign can't do as part of a union in order to protect the citizens, as we have the dual citizenship, national citizenship and state citizenship. And so it's really, we have to find that line somehow. And the Supreme Court started doing that early on, and now we have these examples, these pockmarked examples, and you're giving, you know, the shrimpers and the common cultures. It's all fair to do that. You have to do that. That's all we've got. But I was wondering if you had some formulation by which we make that distinction.
Two quick responses to that, Your Honor. First, I think there's a difference First, the rights that arise out of this right to travel. So all of these in some way arise out of the right to travel, and I think the Supreme Court touched upon that briefly in the Doe versus Bolton case, which is about the right to medical treatment. And that this notion that if we're going to keep citizens from, we're going to incentivize citizens not to travel from place to place because we're going to penalize them for doing so, that implicates the national unity. And that's what the Supreme Court, I think, got at briefly.
Yeah, they've also referred to the notion that if I go buy property in Virginia, I should be able to buy property as a non-citizen just as well as a citizenship, right?
Yeah.
Well, property doesn't travel, it doesn't move. You see the problem I have, and I'm sure we all have, including the lawyers in the case, and I think these arguments have been helpful. That formulation, the Supreme Court hasn't yet yielded it, so we just have to sort of make our way trying to find out what is fundamental right and how is it burdened. It's not the same as due process, and it's not the same as dormant commerce. It's got its own little rules and regulations, so to speak.
And just very briefly, Your Honor, if I might, the other thing I think is there's a distinction between preventing someone from doing something or burdening someone from doing something or just giving, say, a general assistance out of the general fist. I think there's a distinction.
Like telling somebody he has to eat broccoli or can't eat broccoli. Don't ask.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel and proceed to the next case.